See, we miss out so much on seeing what God will do by not giving Him the chance to work on our behalf. Too often we're quick to try to solve our situation, to, you know, take care of what needs to be taken care of rather than trusting the Lord. It's become evident that David still has some room for growth. There's still some chinks in the armor that need to be filled in and refined here in his life. Now, in 1 Samuel 20, the period of time that we're looking at here in David's life, it's a difficult time for David. It's one where he's on the run from Saul often. We're going to see this kind of transition with David where he's sort of moving now away from, seeking to be away from Saul. He's been a shepherd. That's where things started in David's life. He moved from a shepherd and now he's a fugitive. And it's going to be this way for a number of years. And that's very interesting, isn't it? From the time that David was anointed by Samuel at his father Jesse's house until he actually takes the throne is about 15 years. From the time that Samuel says, hey, you're going to be the next king, by which David could have been like, all right, man, I like this. This is going to open up some doors of privilege and prestige, I'm sure. But 15 years where David is going to be on the run, hiding out from a lunatic in Saul. And we see that going on here tonight. And I'm sure it's times where David may have thought and wondered, God, have you forgot about me? God, where are you? Remember that time you had Samuel come to my father's house and say, you're going to be the next king? Remember that? Those are good times, weren't they? What happened to those days? Where are those days? But you see, these were years of preparation, years of building up David to be the right kind of king. David already has a lot of that in place, but there's going to be some time of shaping and preparing in David's life to cause him to be the right kind of king for Israel. It's tough to wait, isn't it? But we see throughout the Bible that God oftentimes brings his people through times of waiting. Don't you hate waiting? Remember as a kid when you were waiting, just even on Christmas Eve to Christmas morning, how long that felt and how difficult that was waiting until Christmas morning. Felt like an eternity, right? Well, the Lord oftentimes brings his people through times of waiting, but they're not times of just being shelved. They're not times of just sitting doing nothing. They're times of learning, times of growth, so that he can do a greater work in and through the people that he's going to use. Galatians 6:9 says, let's not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap. It's a good promise, isn't it? Don't grow weary while doing good. Don't sit there and think, there's no point to this. All I've been doing is waiting. There's no good coming. Oh, don't grow weary while doing good, for in due season you will reap. It's a good promise to hold on to in our times of waiting. That due season just looks differently in God's economy than it does in ours, doesn't it? But learn those times to trust him. So we're going to see some reasons why David needed to learn these lessons of trusting the Lord, because we're seeing a man who's going to become a little bit too reliant on other people and other means. He's going to be reliant upon himself rather than on God. And so in chapters 20, 21, we see this happening in David's life, something that God wants to root out of David and cause him to be a man that's solely leaning on and trusting in the Lord. So we're going to look at seven things here in our two chapters. We're going to look at the problem that we're going to see here, verses 1 to 11. The problem is that David's a hunted man, all right? We're going to see the promise that's made, the plan. We're going to see the provocation with Saul and Jonathan, the predicament that now puts David in. We're going to see the pretense of David in chapter 21, and then the panic by David at the end of chapter 21. So that's kind of our outline. We're going to follow along here. Look at 1 Samuel 20, verse 1. Let's read the first four verses. And this is what we read. Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and went and said to Jonathan, what have I done? What's my iniquity? And what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life? So Jonathan said to him, by no means, you shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing, either great or small, without first telling me. Why should my father hide this thing from me? It's not so. David, you're talking crazy talk here. Verse 3, then David took an oath again and said, your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes. And he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death. So Jonathan said to David, whatever you yourself desire, I will do it for you. So now remember where we left off at the end of chapter 19. Saul is there prophesying among the prophets. He's stripped down. He's not completely naked, but it says he's naked. He's taken off his outer garments. And he's just basically lying there now prophesying. The Holy Spirit has come upon him. Not that Saul is now walking in the Spirit or being a spiritual man, but it's something that the Holy Spirit has taken him over and allowed David to escape. And so you saw that at the end of chapter 19. David now flees from Naoth in Ramah and went to Jonathan. And so we're seeing God's provision in leading David away from Saul when Saul was after him. So he comes to Jonathan for help. He's wondering, Jonathan, what gives here? Why is your father just hell-bent on taking my life? Why is he after me like this? He wants to kill me. And Jonathan is trying to comfort David. Say, like, no. You got all wrong, man. My father would never do anything like this. And I'm sure Jonathan is reflecting upon a time that he's also confronted his father previously. Said, why are you doing this? And he kind of caused his father to sort of step back from that notion of taking David's life. He's seen his father now prophesying. Maybe Jonathan's going, hey, my dad, man, he's turned over a new leaf. He's a spiritual man now. He's prophesying. Oh, this man now, he's not going to do any harm to you, David. And Jonathan's trying to think you're going to be okay here. I'm sure David is thinking, hey, where were you when he was throwing spears at me? A couple times here, like three times now already by this point. Like, where were you, Jonathan? I don't know if you know the whole story here. But David, under oath, lets Jonathan know, hey, this is a serious matter. I'm not just making things up. He again, in verse 3, takes an oath. It says, your father certainly knows that I found favor in your eyes. In other words, David's saying, your dad's keeping this from you because he knows the relationship we have now. And he knows you're going to be really upset if he tells, hey, Jonathan, by the way, that best friend of yours, David, yeah, say your goodbyes because, man, I'm taking him out. Saul's not going to do something like that. David's saying he knows of our relationship. We're good friends. He's not going to tell you. And David has said something here. He says, there is but a step between me and death. End of verse 3. There is but a step between me and death. See, David isn't doubting Jonathan's words by any means. He's just letting him know, Jonathan, you don't know the whole story here. You're not getting the whole picture. I think you are hoping for the best for your dad, but the reality is something very differently. There is but a step between me and death. David's had to do that, literally. He's had to like take a step and avoid the spears getting thrown his way. He's had to move quickly and go, man, if I didn't take that step, I would have been a goner. There's a step between me and death. It reveals a great truth for all of us, I believe, that we are but one step away from eternity. Well, I'm not saying, hey, guys, your next step, man, get ready to meet God. I'm not saying that, but I think it's important for us to live a life where we recognize, you know what, I am only literally one step away from heaven. I'm not guaranteed tomorrow. I'm not guaranteed that I'm going to make it out of this building. Like, we are not guaranteed the next breath. Are you prepared to meet with the Lord? Are you living with an eternal perspective saying, there is but a step between me and death? I don't know when that day is going to come, but God does. But I know I'm not guaranteed. I want to live ready. In other words, I want to live ready that whenever that day is, when the Lord decides to call me home, that I'm ready to stand before him. I'm ready to move into eternity. I think everything we do would change drastically if we truly felt like this could be our last day here. I think it's important to live that way, to live all out for Jesus, to say, man, I never know when I'll have another chance to live for him, to glorify him, to speak of him. Well, again, this deep friendship comes through in that Jonathan is ready to put his life on the line now and do whatever is needed to help David out. That's true commitment here. Jonathan's ready to step in and say, all right, whatever you yourself desire, verse 4, I will do it for you. That's what we should be willing to do among our relationships, especially those centered in Christ. They say, I'm here to serve. I'm here to honor you. I want to put your interest above my interest. It's what Jesus did for us when he laid his life down and he gave himself so that we could have life in him. I'm so thankful for that. Well, verse 5 goes on to say, and David said to Jonathan, indeed, tomorrow is the new moon, and I should not fail to sit with the king to eat, but let me go that I may hide in the field until the third day at evening. If your father misses me at all, then say, David earnestly asked permission of me that he might run over to Bethlehem, his city, for there is a yearly sacrifice there for all the family. If he says thus, it is well, your servant will be safe. But if he's very angry, be sure that evil is determined by him. Therefore, you shall deal kindly with your servant, for you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. Nevertheless, if there's iniquity in me, kill me yourself, for why should you bring me to your father? So David now is devising a way for Jonathan to see for himself whether Saul has it in for David or not, and whether Saul is just, you know, completely pursuing to kill David or not. Now, there's some questions of ethics that gets kind of brought up here. See, David is telling Jonathan, I need you to tell a lie. Tell him that I've gone back home for the yearly sacrifice there. Tell him I've gone back to my father's house to do this. It's a lie. He's telling Jonathan, I need you to lie and just set this scenario up to see how your father responds. And that's a big ethical question gets brought up, where is it okay to lie when in times of trouble? Is it okay to tell a lie? See, attempting to justify lying is a very slippery slope. And God, I think, has made it very clear throughout Scripture that we're to be people of our word, because he is a God of his word. This is something that God cannot do. God cannot lie, the Bible says. And he's a man of his word. He's a God of his word. And he expects us to be people of our word. And yet, we have accounts in Scripture where there were those that lied to defend life, to protect life. And it seemed like it was okay. We got the scenario of the Hebrew wives to protect the newborn Hebrew babies, Exodus chapter 1. We've got Rahab protecting the Israelite spies and lying about their whereabouts, Joshua chapter 2, verse 5. And it almost seems like an honorable thing, yet nowhere, and you have to remember this, nowhere does the Bible condone these actions as much as they may have been helpful at the time. The Bible is revealing these things as descriptive narrative to simply show what was taking place. These are never written to be prescriptive in a sense where here's what you can now do because the Bible is allowing it. And there's a lot of people that can find ways to justify dishonesty today. Some will feel it's okay to kind of fudge your taxes a little bit because the government is just taking way too much. It's rightfully mine, people will say. I forget the percentage of people that cheat on their income taxes, but I don't think it's right at all. That's not the kind of world I want to raise my 26 dependents in. And so it's just not cool. So basically, the test is if Saul responds favorably to David being absent from the king's table. So the new moon festival, which is basically a monthly celebration based on the lunar calendar, when the new moon was first kind of coming, maybe just a sliver of it, they would do a monthly celebration where, again, the king would have all of his guests, or David would have been one of them in the king's court that would have been invited to the table. So it would have been an obvious thing if David's not there. It would have been arranged seating and everything. That would have been it wouldn't have been something that the king would have just sort of missed or overlooked. He would have known exactly David's seat is vacant. It's empty. And if he responds, okay, hey, we're all good. But if he responds in anger that David's not there, then, oh boy, we're in trouble. David recognizes, and he's letting Jonathan see that his father Saul is out for him. So David once again looks to examine himself and see now if there's anything that he's done to cause an unfavorable reaction by Saul. And in verse 8, he's saying, listen, there's iniquity in me. Then, Jonathan, take me out. If I'm the problem, if I'm the one that's provoked your father to this, then if I've done something wrong, you go ahead and take me out. Don't bring me to your father. Let's just skip all that. Take me out now. He's given opportunity to really examine himself here in this. It's always a good thing to do. We typically find it easier to point the finger and say the problem is always with the other person. There's an issue. Oh, it's that person, man. I never do anything wrong. I never. And it's very easy to just kind of look at the other person always when there's a a time of conflict or anything like that. And it's good to examine ourselves. Is there something in me that's brought this on? Am I at fault here in any way? David is basically giving Jonathan license to take him out if he's done wrong rather than have to drag him before Saul. We're reading on in verse 9. But Jonathan said, "Far be it from you. For if I knew certainly that evil was determined by my father to come upon you, then would I not tell you?" Then David said to Jonathan, who will tell me, or what if your father answers you roughly?" Jonathan said to David, "Come, let's go out in the field." So both of them went out into the field. David and Jonathan are working out a way to communicate this, because David's thinking, if your dad does respond roughly, how am I going to know? How are we going to communicate? So Jonathan takes him out of the field. They're going to devise a little plan here now to make this figure out. So here we look at now the promise that's being made between Jonathan and David. Verse 12, "Then Jonathan said to David, 'The Lord God of Israel is witness. When I sounded out my father sometime tomorrow or the third day, and indeed there is good toward David, and I do not send to you and tell you, may the Lord do so and much more to Jonathan. But if it pleases my father to do you evil, then I'll report it to you and send you away, that you may go in safety. And the Lord be with you as he has been with my father.'" So here, Jonathan is committed to protecting David and even doing so at the expense of his own life. He's calling upon God as witness. Jonathan recognizes that, boy, his dad could really sort of take this out on him as well. Now, I'm not too sure when Jonathan says at the end here, "The Lord be with you as he has been with my father." I'm sure David's going, that doesn't help me at all. Your dad is not a good man. And I don't know if God's been with him. He stripped the throne from him. So please don't, you know, ask the Lord to be with me in that way at all. Well, verse 14, "You shall not only show me the kindness of the Lord while I still live, that I may not die, but you shall not cut off your kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord has cut off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord require it at the hand of David's enemies." Now, Jonathan again caused David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. Now, something to take note of here, when Jonathan is saying there, "Don't cut off your kindness," in verse 15, "from my house forever," it was a very common thing when a new king outside of the present family dynasty, the royal dynasty, when a new person, a new king was coming into the throne, they would customarily wipe out all the descendants of that previous king so that there would be no kind of uprising, no rebellion, nobody saying, "Hey, this is rightfully our family's throne, man. We're not going to let you sit on the throne." And so the incoming king would wipe out all the descendants of the previous king. And Jonathan's going, "David, I know you're the king. I know you're the next guy on the throne. Have favor upon my family. Don't see me as the enemy. Don't see my descendants as the enemy." He's looking for that favor from David here. Now, that's amazing because Jonathan is really relinquishing the rights to the throne. He's, as far as the family goes, he's the next guy in line to the throne after Saul. And he's relinquishing his right to the throne. He's laying it all down. He's saying, "Boy, I'm the prince right now, but I'm giving it all over to you, David. I'm surrendering. I'm coming alongside you." This is what makes this friendship so special, is that Jonathan seems to know that David was God's man to be on the throne after Saul, and yet Jonathan had no jealousy. He was ready to support David in spite of what he was having to give up and surrender. We saw in chapter 18 how their souls were knit together. There was such a deep friendship here among these two. And so Jonathan simply asked David to show the same kindness to his family down the road, something David does with one of Jonathan's descendants, Mephibosheth. 2 Samuel chapter 9 is a beautiful story. I would love to get into it tonight, but I'm going to save it for when we're in 2 Samuel 9, all right? Because that's a beautiful story that we see with Mephibosheth and the grace that David shows him. It's a great picture of Jesus bringing all to the king's table who are in covenant with him. And with this covenant that's being made between Jonathan and David here, God's providing for each person exactly what they needed. For David, he now has a confidant in Jonathan to be a buffer for him from Saul's sporadic outbursts. And for Jonathan, he had David loyal to him and his family, protected him after David takes the throne, to where Jonathan could have thought, if there's any other king coming on the throne, I'm a dead man. So God's providing for both David and Jonathan in a wonderful way here. But Jonathan does, as you see there in verse 17, ask for a little bit of assurance. Verse 17, Jonathan asks, again, caused David to vow because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. John's like, David, just remind me again that you're with me here. You love me. You know, I love you. I want to make sure. It's like when with any human relationship, it's nice to hear those words often, right? You don't just say, listen, honey, I told you I love you back when we got married, when we exchanged our vows. Like, do I need to say it every day? Wasn't that good enough? No, like you say that regularly, right, ladies? No? Okay. All right. Trying to help you out here. Okay. But it's nice to hear that. John's like, just reassure me here, David, that we're together on this. Well, here's the plan now unfolding. Verse 18. Then Jonathan said to David, tomorrow's the new moon, and you'll be missed, because your seat will be empty. And when you stayed 3 days, go down quickly and come to the place where you hid on the day of the deed and remain by the stone Ezel. Then I will shoot 3 arrows to the side as though I shot at a target. And there I will send a lad saying, go find the arrows. If I expressly say to the lad, look, the arrows are on this side of you, get them and come. Then, as the Lord lives, there is safety for you and no harm, David. But if I say thus to the young lad, look, the arrows are beyond you, go your way, for the Lord has sent you away. And as for the matter which you and I have spoken of, indeed the Lord be between you and me forever. So, Jonathan and David are on the field devising this plan here now to be able to communicate to David what Saul's intention is without Saul having to see David. He's like, go hide out by the rock there. I'm going to shoot 3 arrows out. And if I say the arrows are beside you, it means, David, you're good. You're safe. Come on out, man. We're all good. If I say the arrows are beyond you to the lad, I'm really speaking that to you, David, that it's time to go. It's time to leave. You need to get out of here because you're right. My father is out for you here. I love the picture. David goes and hides by what seems like a known rock to them. It's named Ezel or Ezel, which means departure. I love the picture here. When times are tough, how we're to hide out in the rock, take refuge in the Lord. And one day we're going to depart from all our troubles and remain safe with him for all eternity. And so David is hiding out by that stone, that rock there. And when the arrows went out, again, the lad would go and retrieve them. Jonathan would have that signal for David to let them know. Well, Jonathan returns back to the feast now. And here we see the provocation taking place. Verse 24. Then David hid in the field, and when the new moon had come, the king sat down to eat the feast. Now the king sat on his seat, as at other times, on a seat by the wall, and Jonathan arose, and Abner sat by Saul's side, Abner the general of the army. But David's place was empty. Nevertheless, Saul did not say anything that day, for he thought, yeah, something has happened to him. He's unclean. Surely he is unclean. And so Saul notices David's absence, right? And Saul just begins to reason himself, I guess David's done something where he's become ceremonially unclean. He's not permitted to come to the feast. He's probably out just getting himself prepared, going through his ritual cleansing, and sure enough, he'll be here tomorrow. So that's what Saul's reasoning is. It's a very possible scenario in that situation. Well, it goes on in verse 27 to say, and it happened the next day, the second day of the month, that David's place was empty. And Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to eat? You see the tone a bit changing now. It's not David, it's son of Jesse. That's a bit kind of not a nice way to refer to David. The son of Jesse has not come to eat either yesterday or today. So Jonathan, verse 28, answered Saul, David earnestly asked permission of me to go to Bethlehem. And he said, please let me go, for our family has a sacrifice in the city, and my brother has commanded me to be there. And now, if I have found favor in your eyes, please let me get away and see my brothers. Therefore, he's not come to the king's table. So the next day, David's not there again. Saul now becomes very suspicious. He refers to David as the son of Jesse. And so Jonathan shares this prepared lie with Saul to see how he's going to handle it. And it's not good. Look at verse 30. Then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan. And he said to him, "You son of a perverse, rebellious woman." This guy's just going off the rails here. "Do I not know that you have chosen the son of Jesse to your own shame and to the shame of your mother's nakedness? For as long as the son of Jesse lives on the earth, you shall not be established, nor your kingdom. Now therefore, send and bring him to me, for he shall surely die." And Jonathan, verse 32, answered Saul. His father said to him, "Why should he be killed? What has he done?" Then Saul cast a spear at him to kill him, by which Jonathan knew. Now he's like, okay, I think David was onto something here. Not only is David saying Saul's out to kill him, now John's going, this guy's ready to kill me, his own son. By which Jonathan knew that it was determined by his father to kill David. So Jonathan, verse 34, arose from the table in fierce anger and ate no food the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had treated him shamefully. So Saul is just going absolutely ballistic here. He's a man just driven by the flesh, driven by jealousy, by anger. He's quick to fly into fits of rage. It's just off the charts. And he starts dragging his poor, innocent wife into all this, calling her a perverse, rebellious woman. Yikes. That's not good. The language is quite vivid in regards to what Saul is saying to Jonathan. Basically, if it was in modern language, it'd be equal to calling him a bastard or you son of a bee. That's what Saul is essentially saying here, all right? Just to make it clear in today's language what is coming out of Saul's mouth, it's not good whatsoever. Saul's all over the map because right after making a diss of Jonathan's mother, he says that Jonathan is going to shame her by his actions. So one minute he's kind of throwing her on the bus. Next he's saying, you are gonna make your mother a real embarrassment here. You're shaming her. Basically saying that her birth of him, when he talks about her shaming your mother's nakedness, speaking about his birth now, when she would have been naked, all exposed, giving birth to Jonathan, that his birth would just be basically wasted now by the kinds of actions that he's taken. Doing so all to her shame and certainly to Saul's shame, that Jonathan's not interested in taking the throne, but is looking to come alongside David here. And Saul's argument is that as long as David is around, and this is what Saul begins to do. He tries to reason with Jonathan. As long as David is around, you're not going to have any way to the throne, Jonathan. Don't you see what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to take out your only competition. Get David out of the way. The throne is yours, Jonathan. I'm just trying to help you. And Saul's trying to justify that. The problem with this is that this is already a done deal. Because it's not David that's standing in the way, it's God that's standing in the way. This is something that God has already said, that Saul or Jonathan is going to have the throne stripped from them. 1 Samuel 15, verse 28 says that Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you." And that conversation began even back in 1 Samuel chapter 13. So Saul has already known for some time that the throne is out of his hands. David is not preventing it from Saul continuing on. God is the one that's doing it. Saul's fighting a losing battle. See, in wrestling for his way, he's only fighting against God. Saul seems to think that there's still a way to retain control, but in doing so, he's only losing control. He's a madman. Again, fueled by jealousy, anger, and rage. And yet, if he had submitted to the will of God and walked in obedience, it could have been a very different outcome for Saul. I wonder how often I forfeit God's blessing and peace because I've not walked in surrender to the Lord's will for my life. Instead of laying myself down, I'm fighting for what I think I need or want. And I'm fighting a losing battle. What a blessing it is to just lay our will to the Father's will and walk in that peace that he has for us. Well, as Jonathan tries to reason with his father, again, his father, as we read, turns on him, throws a spear to take out Jonathan. He's lost all sanity because ironically, Saul's like, "Jonathan, I'm just trying to help you get to the throne. We're just trying to see the family name continue on." And yet he's willing to take Jonathan out, which is going to not help matters with keeping that dynasty on the throne. It's this completely insanity now that's driving Saul here. Well, Jonathan now knows that David is absolutely right in his assessment. It's time to say their goodbyes. So look at the predicament now that we see. Verse 35. And so it was in the morning that Jonathan went out into the field at the time appointed with David, and a little lad was with him. Then he said to his lad, now run, find the arrows which I shoot. As the lad ran, he shot an arrow beyond him. When the lad had come to the place where the arrow was, which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan cried out after the lad and said, is not the arrow beyond you? And Jonathan cried out after the lad, make haste, hurry, do not delay. Words intended for David. So Jonathan's lad gathered up the arrows and came back to his master. But the lad did not know anything, only Jonathan and David knew the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, go carry them to the city. And as soon, verse 41, as soon as the lad had gone, David arose from a place toward the south, fell on his face to the ground, and bowed down three times. And they kissed one another, and they wept together. But David more so. Then Jonathan said to David, go in peace, since we have both sworn in the name of the Lord, saying, may the Lord be between you and me, between your descendants and my descendants forever. So he arose and departed, and Jonathan went into the city. So it's interesting that they've devised this plan for David to be able to flee when he hears, they're beyond you, go, make haste. But yet now they have a meetup. It's possible that Jonathan didn't expect that they would have that opportunity apart from Saul witnessing it. So perhaps Saul is now moved somewhere where they're able to, David's able to come out from that stone of Ezel and come and meet with Jonathan now. But they have this final tearful goodbye together. And from this point on, Jonathan and David are only going to see each other one other time and really just kind of in passing. This is kind of it for them. There's been a deep covenantal relationship where, again, their souls were knit together as one. There's a deep admiration and respect for each other, but now they're not going to have any joy of hanging out, going on any hunting escapades. Friendship is such a valuable gift that we must not take for granted. And there's some great verses, Proverbs 17:17, a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. Proverbs 18:24, a man who has friends must himself be friendly, but there's a friend who sticks closer than a brother. And so if we want to know this kind of a friendship, I mean, the Bible makes pretty clear, you got to be that kind of a friend too. Man who has friends must himself be friendly. That's evident of a person has lots of friends, is that they are a friendly person. And how it's such a special gift to have that deep kind of connection and bond with another person where, again, you can just kind of share in all these things. And David and Jonathan had that for each other. Such a valuable gift, I believe, to each of them, to where now in their goodbye, they're coming together and they're kissing. Now, again, all completely platonic. This is a very big custom in this day where a lot of people love to try to put a spin on this, and a lot of liberals would love to put a spin on this and say, see, David and Jonathan, they were more than just friends, you know. They entered into a whole different kind of relationship. That's just not the case, because this is something that's very customary in that day, even today in the Middle East, where you'll go and you'll have a man kiss another man as a greeting, and that's just kind of a commonplace kind of a thing. So nothing strange or weird going on here, but two men that had deep admiration and respect for each other know that this is likely it for them. Well, as we continue along in the story, we're going to see it's not going to be an easy path for David over the next number of years. But again, it's a plan it's a path with purpose. It's a path with purpose because it's God's purpose for David in and through all this. Despite all that David goes through, God's at work. You know, again, we can often think when we're on that avenue of difficulty, that's because we've done something wrong. And it's punishment. But oftentimes that path is God's way of preparing us for what he has in store for us. And it's going to be so in the life of David. And as we'll see, there are still areas in David's life that need to be surrendered to the Lord. Still areas that God is still, you know, preparing him and refining him in. And we see that clearly here in chapter 21, a short chapter. We'll finish up with this chapter tonight here. And it says in chapter 21, verse 1, now David came to Nob to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, why are you alone and no one is with you? So David said to Ahimelech the priest, the king has ordered me on some business and said to me, do not let anyone know anything about the business on which I send you or what I've commanded you. And I've directed my young man to such and such a place. Now, therefore, what have you on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread in my hand or whatever can be found. So David is now, he's on the run as a fugitive. He knows Saul is again out to take his life. So Saul is trying to stay 2 steps ahead of Saul. He's living as a fugitive now, and he's going to be that way for many years. And so he comes and seeks help from Ahimelech the priest. Now, Nob was a priestly city 3 miles south of Gibeah where the tabernacle was located at this time. Remember, the ark is still sitting at Kiriath-Jearim, but the tabernacle presently is at Nob, and it's a priestly city, and here's Ahimelech that David comes and sees. And Ahimelech is a little bit suspicious, because David had been appointed, you know, a captain of the army, and he's thinking, what's going on here now? David's coming alone. Like, is he sent on a mission from Saul? Maybe doesn't really know what's really going on. He's a little bit suspicious about this. But notice David, as he comes, he's looking for provision. He's looking for protection. Yet, again, he comes now without trusting the Lord. Because notice what he says. He says, the king has ordered me on some business. And again, it's a blatant lie. David is resorting now to deception to keep him safe rather than letting the Lord be the one that keeps him safe. He's willing at one time to stand up to a Philistine giant, but he's wilting under a fleshly Israelite king. And yet the same Lord that defeated that giant is the same Lord that's going to protect David against a crazy man like Saul. See, we miss out so much on seeing what God will do by not giving him the chance to work on our behalf. Too often we're quick to try to solve our situation, to, you know, take care of what needs to be taken care of rather than trusting the Lord. It's become evident that David still has some room for growth. There's still some chinks in the armor that need to be filled in and refined here in his life. So David's essentially wondering as he comes, is there any food? A little bit hungry, been on a bit of a journey. Anything for me? And the priest answered verse 4 and said, well, there's no common bread on hand, but there's holy bread. If the young men have at least kept themselves from women, then David answered the priest and said to him, truly, women have been kept from us about 3 days since I came out, and the vessels of the young men are holy, and the bread is in effect common, even though it was consecrated in the vessel this day. So the priest gave him holy bread, for there was no bread there, but the showbread, which had been taken from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place on the day when it was taken away. Now, just a little clarity here. When you would go into the tabernacle, when you walked in on the left side, or sorry, on the right side was the table of showbread. On the right side, table of showbread that had 2 stacks of bread, 6 high, 12 in total, representing the 12 tribes of Israel. Since eating in that day was such a picture of strong, intimate fellowship, those 12 pieces of bread were to symbolize that kind of fellowship that God had with the 12 tribes of Israel. And the bread was to be replaced each week, reminding us of how our fellowship and devotional life needs to remain fresh. Don't just rely upon stale leftovers or anything like that. It needs to remain fresh. So a new bread was brought in. The priests now were allowed to eat the old bread. And that was God's way of providing for the priests in their priestly service. God had all worked out here now to meet their needs. Well, there's some uncertainty whether this bread should be given to David and his men. But upon some examination as to their purity, the priest decides, it's okay, I'm going to give this bread to David. Now, though you can make a case to say it was unlawful for David to have this bread because it was bread intended for the priest, Jesus himself used this very story here in 1 Samuel 21 to defend his disciples when they were plucking heads of grain through the field on the Sabbath. And the Pharisees came to Jesus and said, hey, how come you're allowing your disciples to do what's unlawful on the Sabbath? Because just plucking that heads of grain and rubbing your hand, it was kind of like you were threshing now. You were doing work on the Sabbath in the eyes of the Pharisees. It's not exactly how the law was written out, but it was the interpretation of the religious leaders that this was now breaking the Sabbath as they began to add so many rules to God's law. So the Pharisees saw this as unlawful, and yet Jesus said, remember, Hold up, guys. Remember when David went into the tabernacle when he was hungry? He went and ate the consecrated bread that was for the priest only. And Jesus uses that to say that was allowed because human need must always supersede religious rule. That's what Jesus was showing to the Pharisees. Human need must always supersede religious rule. Ahimelech showed that. Jesus showed that with his disciples. It's better to have a person helped than to have a law protected. So, interesting account that Jesus brings up here in that situation when he was confronted by the religious leaders. So David receives his bread. But then in verse 7, now a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord. And his name was Doeg, an Edomite, the chief of the herdsmen who belonged to Saul. And David said to Ahimelech, is there not here on hand a spear or a sword? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me because the king's business required haste. So the priest said in verse 9, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine whom you killed in the valley of Elah, there it is, wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you'll take that, go ahead and have it, take it, for there's no other except that one here. David said, there's none like it. Give it to me. So David now, as he's talking with him, like as he's receiving this bread, he suddenly realizes there's a representative of Saul there, one of his chief herdsmen there. And David recognizes, oh boy, this guy's going to give me away before Saul. Or he thinks maybe this man is going to try to take David's life himself. So David says, hey, you got any? I'm empty-handed right now. Do you got any protection around here for me? And there happens to be the sword of Goliath sitting there. But again, it's kind of a sad commentary on the heights by which David has fallen, because when he faced the giant and captured his sword, he did so through trusting in the Lord, and he abandoned conventional weapons, right? Saul's trying to fit him in his armor. David says, I can't wear these. He goes out with nothing but a sling and stone. He takes down a giant. And now he's fearing over this man, Doeg, an Edomite, thinking, what do you got in here? I need something. He's turning to the things of the world. He's putting his hope and trust in the wrong things. And we're starting to see this slide in David's life. And it only gets worse. Because lastly, we see the panic now of David. Look at what he does here in verse 10. Then David arose and fled that day from before Saul and went to Achish, the king of Gath. And the servants of Achish said to him, is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of him to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s? David is completely moving in fear. And fear will often lead you to do things that are neither helpful nor healthy. Here's David now leaving the tabernacle to go where? To Philistine territory. And not only that, he goes to Goliath's hometown with his sword in his hand. David, are you out of your mind right now? This is nuts. And he begins to act like it. Verse 12. Now David took these words to heart when he began to hear what those in Gath were saying. And he was very much afraid of Achish, the king of Gath. So he changed his behavior before them, pretended madness in their hands, scratched on the doors of the gate, and let his saliva fall down on his beard. My goodness. To do that, that was just a very, you know, sad, sordid state for anybody to be reflecting that. And then Achish said to the servants, look, you see the man, he's insane. Look at him. Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of madmen that you should have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come into my house? Now, in ancient times, madness was associated with being controlled by an evil spirit. Not only that, but now, since being controlled by an evil spirit, they thought that person is set apart to the gods, almost like holy to these false gods, special, in other words. So nobody wanted to do any harm to David, thinking that, boy, he's possessed by something out of this world, is kind of what they were thinking. And so David is feigning this kind of insanity, letting his spit fall down his beard, scratching on the gate on the door there now. And he's pretending to be a madman. Somewhere through the scene, however, and this is interesting, David seemed to learn to give it over to the Lord. And the Lord protected him. Psalm 34, actually, you would just turn there with me. Psalm 34. Psalm 34. Because notice what we see in the inscription in Psalm 34 at the beginning. A psalm of David when he pretended madness before Abimelech, who drove him away and he departed. See, something happened in this scene here now. Obviously, the men of Gath, who rightfully so could have taken David's life, saying, you just killed our biggest hero, our biggest warrior. But they didn't. And here again, the Lord is showing David, I'm going to protect you. I'm with you. When you think that you got to protect yourself, you got to handle things yourself, you need to learn to trust in me. And David, notice what he goes on to say here in Psalm 34, I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make its boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear of it and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name forever. I sought the Lord and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. They looked to him and were radiant and their faces were not ashamed. This poor man cried out and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps all around those who fear him and delivers him. Go down to verse 19. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. He guards all his bones. Not one of them is broken. Evil shall say the wicked, and those who hate the righteous shall be condemned. The Lord redeems the soul of his servants, and none of those who trust in him shall be condemned. David, through these experiences, though he's walking in the wrong way, taking the wrong path, the Lord is leading him down a path of purpose to reveal to him that the Lord is truly all that David needs in these times, and David needs to learn to trust him all the more. Well, a few points to ponder here. First of all, waiting on God is not wasted time. It's shaping time. David's delay was not God's neglect. It was God's preparation. This time in David's life is a time where he's going to be on the run, but it's time that God's going to be doing a work. Secondly, godly friendships are one of God's great gifts in tough times. When Saul is attacking David's peace, Jonathan is building up David's faith. May we have those kinds of friends around us that can be that encouragement and support, and may we be those kinds of friends to others as well. Number three, the safest place is not the absence of danger, but the presence of God. Where do I run first when hit with fear? God's presence or my own devices? May we be unlike David here, who runs into further trouble being driven by his fear. May we be unlike that and rather say, Lord, I'm going to run to you. I'm not going to run away from your presence. I'm going to run into your presence and stay close to you in all these times. So